Seems like interest in using native plants in home gardens just continues to grow, and it's no surprise since they have a lot of qualities to recommend them. For example, this summer with the drought conditions, we were able to see how they do in those extreme situations. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along for another edition of Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. My guest today, Neil DeBole from Prairie Nursery. He comes by a few times a year to talk with us about how to use native plants and why you should appreciate them. And Neil, always great to have you with us.
My pleasure, Larry.
Appreciate it very much. What should we be doing to get our prairie plantings ready for fall for those who have them?
Well, if you're looking at new plantings or existing plantings, are you thinking, Larry?
Well, let's take a look at either. Let's take new and then take existing.
Okay. Fall is actually an excellent time to plant seeds and transplants, assuming, and this is a very important assumption, assuming that your site is ready to go. And what does ready to go mean? It means that all the weeds, grasses, everything is gone. Because you got to make sure it is a pristine, clean slate before you put in your plants and seeds. Because if, as every gardener knows, if you don't get the weeds out first, Lord help you, they're going to be back.
Yep.
Okay. But fall is a particularly good time if you are interested in planting seeds. And the reason for that is that most of our wildflowers do better with a fall seeding, which is the way they naturally occur in nature. And many of them have dormancies that have to be overcome in order for them to germinate at a high rate in the spring. And one of the natural kind of preventative measures that nature takes is the seeds have to be exposed to cold, moist temperatures in the soil, which tells them winter occurred. For instance, let's say I'm a seed, I fall on the ground September 15th, it's raining, it's 75 degrees, it's perfect germination conditions, I germinate, and in November it's 10 below and I'm dead. So the seeds have this built-in mechanism that says, hey, you got to be exposed to winter conditions in order to break dormancy, and then they germinate the next spring. So we see much higher germination of flowers when seeded in the fall. The exception to the better germination rule is that most of our warm season grasses, like big bluestem, little bluestem, Indian grass, Cytos grama, these generally do much more poorly when seeded in the fall. There's something that happens to that seed over the winter, and we don't get the same levels of germination as we would with a May or June seeding with the warm season grasses. Exceptions, prairie drop seed, which is a gorgeous, gorgeous native prairie grass, which is kind of tricky when seeded, and it doesn't really work if you seed it after May 1st, but it does great when it's seeded in the fall or in very early spring. Some people will do what we call a frost seeding or a snow seeding on top of the snow any time in the winter, and then the seed works its way down over the winter, or you plant prairie drop seed very early before May 1st, and you usually get very good germination.
Do you have woodland plantings? Would they be any different?
Woodland plantings, a totally different story, absolutely. Most of your woodland plants and seeds are best planted in the fall. A lot of the woodland seeds require this exposure to cold, damp conditions, a process called moist stratification. And most of your woodland plants do require that. So you're much farther ahead. If you actually have woodland seeds, then the best thing to do is to plant them in the fall. Woodland seeds are hard to come by because they're hard to collect. They're available in small quantities. They're not commercially available on a large scale. They're very expensive. Some people collect their own seeds. Generally speaking, when you collect a woodland seed, the best thing to do is to plant it right away. Whether you collect it in June or July or August, get it in the ground right away. That's the best thing to do, and put it right where you want it to come up. It'll come up the next spring. Notable exceptions, members of the lily family, things like the trilliums, the white trilliums, all the trilliums, and the smilacinas, the false Solomon seals, and the plugonotums. These are double dormant, and it takes 2 years in the soil before they will germinate. They're kind of tricky.
What about, well, we're talking about seeds here, but what about transplanting or dividing native plants?
Transplanting and dividing in the fall is excellent for most native plants. You want to wait until they're dormant. Most of your woodland plants are best divided in the fall, and most, not all, but most woodland plants are dormant by midsummer, especially your spring ephemerals. So they're easy to divide in the fall. In fact, that's the best time, and they're pre-positioned because they come up so early in the spring. It's sometimes hard to get in there in the spring, especially if it's a wet, rainy spring like we had this year. You go in there and you're mucking around in the clay and the mud, and it's just like, and then the plants are growing, and you really don't want to divide them when they're growing most times. You want to do them when they're dormant for best results. Things like bloodroot, you can just break the rhizomes apart. The Solomon seals, those are very, very easy to divide. They're not quite dormant yet, but wait until September, October when all the leaves are gone. May apples, just take a 6-inch to 8-inch rhizome off of that, stick it in the ground, and stand back. Here it comes. So, you know, so there are a lot of your woodland plants that do very well. And also, prairie plants do fine when plant, most, almost all of them do fine, including the grasses, do fine when planted in, September, October. You don't want to get too late. And one of the very important steps you take with fall transplants is after they become established somewhat in the fall, then after they go dormant, usually around Thanksgiving, I like to cover them with 3 to 5, maybe even 6 inches of clean straw. If it's a woodland planting, in my woodland gardens, I just use the leaves I rake up off my lawn. And my neighbors in town, they're so kind. They bag up all their leaves and put them in bags so I can come and pick them up and take them to my garden. It's extremely thoughtful. So people see me around throwing bags of leaves in my car. What's that guy doing? I'm taking it to my garden. But they're very important to cover your transplants in the fall so they do not experience winter damage due to cold temperatures, because they're not usually fully established after that fall transplant.
Now, if I were you, I would not bag near Judith Sears Poisson's home because she has black walnuts. Trees everywhere.
I look at the trees in people's yards. You're a very good point, Larry. I look for sugar maples and ashes, as long as they'll last, cherries, basswoods. Yeah. And it's another thing. I have mostly oaks, and that's what I've got. So I thank God I have some elms. They deteriorate more rapidly. The oaks don't deteriorate as rapidly, so you may want to go a little light on the oaks. They also have more. They tend to be a little more acid, but it's usually not a big problem on our soils here because they are fairly alkaline.
You know, this summer was so different from last year.
Yeah, until the last couple of weeks.
Until the last couple of weeks. I mean, we had drought last year. Now we're getting into drought condition again.
Yeah. We had so much rain this spring, and of course, When you're in my business, you look at that rain in the spring and go, we're going to get stuck with the bill in summer. It's going to even out. And that's what it's done. I think a lot of people in the South got some rain, and people in the North got some rain. But in the central part of the state, we're really dry. And I was up north with a client last week, and central Wisconsin all the way up north, but a lot of really, really dry conditions. And we're getting pretty dry, too. So we could certainly benefit from some rain. But we're not seeing anything like last year. I mean, the prairie plants are just like, they're fine. It's not even, it's not so hot.
Right.
It's like we're 20 degrees less than we were last year. It was 105, and now it's like 85.
Yeah.
Or 95, or 75. So we haven't had the heat stress that we had last year, but we're getting pretty dry. We'd like to get some rain at some point.
Alan Westby has a question. Hi, Al. Thank you for calling.
I got a couple questions. First of all, are tiger lilies, the orange lilies with the black spots, are they native?
No, the tiger lilies are not native. They're a garden import. And one thing you want to be careful, the tiger lilies carry a virus which can infect your native lilies like the Turk's cap lily. In fact, we had this problem in our nursery. We had this tiger lily growing outside of the office that just appeared. So I didn't, it's nice. I'll leave it there. And my native lilies were getting this virus, but the tiger lilies do not express it. They are merely a host and a carrier. So I had to get rid of the tiger lilies because they were harming my lilies. But no, tiger lilies are not native. If you want, you can propagate them by taking those little black beads off of them and stick those in the ground, and you'll get a new plant. They come up very slowly, but you will get a new plant. But
cattails, are they native?
There are two different species of cattails that we typically see in Wisconsin, the wide-leaf cattail and the narrow-leaf cattail. The narrow-leaf cattail is an import. Some places considered a pest. Frankly, a lot of my customers consider all of them pests, native or non-native. They do tend to colonize moist areas, especially areas that have fluctuating water, less than 2 feet, and then drying out in the summer. Almost any time you dig a pond and leave any amount of exposed soil, you're almost certain to get cattails. They're really hard to keep out because the seeds travel by wind, and once they get established, they creep relatively rapidly. They are great for muskrats, blackbirds, so they're not without value. But you get rather these big monocultures of cattails, and they're not necessarily as biodiverse as a nice wetland planting around a pond.
There you go.
Okay. And pampas grass is not native, is it?
No, and what most people call pampas grass is miscanthus, but the true pampas grass doesn't grow here. It's hardy to about zone 8, and that is cordaderia, which is actually from the pampas of Argentina. But people call the miscanthus, which is actually the correct common name, is maiden grass. Everybody calls it pampas grass. It's not native. There are different varieties, many different varieties on the market. Some creep rapaciously by runners, and I would never plant them. And others behave themselves and pretty much stay where they are. in zones, particularly out east in zones 6 and 7 and 8, they have become a real, real invasive problem. North Carolina, Delaware, these areas, some of these miscanthus have become really noxious weeds almost. So you want to be careful when you're bringing in some of these non-native plants.
Okay. Thank you.
You bet. Thanks for calling.
Thanks very much for calling. Sort of a non sequitur here, but I when he mentioned cattails and you mentioned blackbirds, I was just reminded of my mother and dad. My dad out musky fishing and coming in on their boat with and watching a blackbird, and they were just sort of easing in. A blackbird was on a cattail, and it was kind of bent over, and suddenly there was this big splash. And a big muskie came out of the water, took the blackbird off the cattail, and that was the end. They were lucky to see something. They're both looking at the same time and saw that.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So muskies eat blackbirds.
If they can get their mouth around one, yeah.
How did the muskie know it was there? You could see all the way up through the water.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
Unbelievable.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Unbelievable.
Connie in Williams Bay, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, good morning. I have a question about echinacea or purple coneflower. I have a perennial garden, and I have a lot of purple coneflower. But I notice every once in a while the flowers will not get petals. So it's kind of like an unexploded firework or something. You know, so it's just the seed head without petals that grow, or else every once in a while the seed has become sort of deformed and they're misshapen. Is that a fungus or there's something wrong with these plants?
Yeah, and sometimes they'll have like these almost greenish petals, right?
Yes.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's almost certainly a virus that's gotten into the flower, and you will see that occasionally. In fact, there are some of these weird varieties. And Echinacea has been selected for all kinds of weird varieties, and actually somebody is selling some of these really weird ones, and they come up with some fancy name and people buy it. But it's almost certainly a virus that's causing that. It's probably only – is it infecting only a few of your plants, right? Not all of them?
Well, I have a lot of plants, but it only affects a few of them.
Yeah. If you don't like it, the best thing to do would be to cut those off as soon as you see them and dispose of them, get them out of your garden. And don't put them in a compost pile. Get them out, like throw them in the trash or something.
Right. Okay. So would you recommend completely – you know, taking out all the plants to stop that spread, or
try just cutting off the heads and see if that works. If it comes back, then you may want to remove those plants.
Okay. Great. Thanks.
Right. Okay, you bet. Good luck.
Thanks a lot for calling. And Jim in Colfax. Hello.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a kind of a two-part question. I have my wife and I purchased 3 acres on one side of the road and a 5-acre old farmstead on the other side of the road. Where we live is on the side, has absolutely no trees, nothing. It was a field, and a mobile home was on it, and there's basically I got a 3-acre lawn with nothing. So for the last 3 years, we've been, you know, growing corn and soybeans out there on about 2 acres of it, and so I only have to mow an acre. And I'm kind of getting tired of having to till it up and plant something every year, so I'd like to just turn it into basically a wild prairie patch for it. And the second part of the question is, and where would I get the seed, and can you buy it in a bulk enough to do a couple acres? And would I spray it first, and kind of the details of what it would take to totally turn this into a flowered lawn type of deal out there for the wildlife? The second part is, on my 5 acres, it's an old farmstead, there's 30 to 40 walnut trees. There's also about 3/4 acre of a horse pasture that we use as a garden, and soybeans, part of it's for the soybeans for the deer again, and a little food plot. It's all wooded except for where the building sites are. And with all these walnut trees, I've always hearing that they're toxic to the soil and things, but I noticed that my garden doesn't suffer. I have a very, very beautiful garden. There's even a walnut tree that shades some of it. But the only thing I haven't been able to grow is radishes and onions. So I'm wondering what do the walnuts trees kill, so that I'm, you know, because I do have a good garden, but I also have a lot of wild flowers there. The tiger lilies you're talking about, lots of neat things.
Tomatoes?
In between the buildings that have grown up.
Do you have tomatoes?
Yeah, the tomatoes are awesome. I mean, I got 30 plants this year, and I just picked, I don't know, 20 of them the other night to start making, you know, salsa and things like that with.
Well, Jim, how far away are the tomatoes from your walnut trees?
One walnut tree is literally overshading the garden. It's not a huge tree. It's probably 8 inches in diameter. The rest of the walnut trees are about 40, 50 yards away from it, all up through the driveway.
That's
throughout the property.
Yeah, the walnuts have to be fairly close in order for the toxic material. The material is called juglone, and it's emitted by the leaves, the seeds, the roots, etc. So if the trees are sufficiently far away, you shouldn't have a problem with it. But,
okay. So if they're not, the leaves aren't falling into the soil that I'm using to grow the garden, then I'm okay.
Generally speaking, although the roots can extend beyond the drip line of the tree, and they can also emit the toxin, so it can be actually farther than the drip line or the leaves.
That one that's shading your garden, once it's a little bigger, you're not going to be happy.
Yeah, there are. It's a surprising. If you come to Prairie Nursery and go to our display gardens, we have a lot of woodland plants under almost a pure stand of walnut trees, and it's kind of a torture chamber, and we're really finding out what works and what doesn't. It's surprising. A very significant number of native plants will grow under black walnut, not all of them, and we're compiling a list of that now. And
My bean plants are directly underneath the walnut tree, and they're doing excellent. The rest of it is out into the full sun then.
Well, that's pretty fascinating. That's pretty amazing. But to get back to your first area, the 3-acre area where you have 2 acres of the corn and the beans, that's actually an optimal situation for converting into a prairie. I'm assuming that you've kept the weeds under control during these crops of corn and beans. Is that correct?
Correct. Yep. They get sprayed and you know, we grew sweet corn the last couple of years and, you know, almost an acre of it, and we just give it away to whoever wants to stop and pick it.
Wow.
Kind of the neighborhood patch, help yourself, because it's just fun to watch it grow, and then whatever's left the deer get. And,
sure.
And it's been excellent. It's been really a blessing to be able to watch the deer and the wildlife come in, the turkeys. You know, the rest of it has been planted into a regular cornfield. And last year we did harvest some of it because of the expense of the corn. You know, $800 worth of corn coming off there just for an acre and a half.
Sure.
But, you know, then the turkeys and the deer come, you know, they just flood it in the wintertime.
Oh, that's great.
Every day you look out the window and I get wildlife.
Sure. Yeah. And they'll come to your prairie, too, if you convert that to prairie. What the best thing to do here is you have that in corn or beans this year, Jim?
Actually, this is the first year we planted the corn, the sweet corn across the road on my 5 acres, and we didn't put anything in there. It was tilled up twice getting ready to do it, but it just didn't happen. So last year it was a solid cornfield.
Okay. Are there weeds in there now?
Yes.
Okay. Have they gone to seed yet?
Yes.
Okay. Well, you had a great situation until now. Because now the weeds have gone to seed, so they're putting more seeds into your area. What I would suggest is, how tall are the weeds right now?
Well, it was tilled up in early July, so they probably haven't completely gone to seed.
Okay.
I still get it under control.
Okay, good. Yeah, they probably won't be early July. You're just in time. The best thing to do right now, if this is acceptable, you can go out there and just spray that area with Roundup to kill the weeds. Roundup, or glyphosate. Doesn't have to be Roundup. That's one of the brand names.
But, sure.
And kill those weeds. And then just let it sit. Don't till it. Don't touch it. Just let it sit. And then next spring, let the weeds come up, and when the weeds are about 12 to 14 inches tall next spring, which will probably be late May, spray it one more time, and then you should be ready to seed your prairie. And if you want, we'd be happy to send you one of our catalogs, and you can see the different seed mixes. We have a wide variety of seed mixes for all kinds of soil conditions, whether it's dry, sandy, rocky soils, or clay soils, or good loamy medium soils.
And while we're at it, I want to go back to the juglone. Judith was reminding me about some of the things that actually grow around black walnuts, and beans are one, and corn, squash, beets, melons, carrots, pretty much all okay with walnuts. And also black raspberries.
Black raspberries, really, but not red.
Nope.
Oh, isn't that fascinating?
Yeah.
Wow.
So
does that answer your question as far as the area across the road there, Jim?
Yeah, do you get like a seed mixture? Do they come with like 6 different varieties of flowers in there and things that would just, and then they would take over and come back year after year after year then?
Exactly. They're almost all perennials, a few biennials. Our mixes have anywhere from 18 to 25 flowers or more in them, and then 3 to 6 grasses, 8 grasses, depending on the mix. So if you want, you can call our office. Unfortunately, our website is down right now. Our internet service provider is having problems with their computers, so all of the websites that they host are down, which is really a drag.
Yeah.
But for anybody that would like to get more information, you can call our office for a catalog, and that number is 1-800 476 1-800-GROW-9453. And if you're driving, just remember 1-800-GROW-WILD, GROWILD. So people are there to answer the phones, and they'll be happy to take your information and send you a catalog.
Neil DeBoe, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin, our guest. You can join in with your questions and comments at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking prairies and native plantings today. Late summer care for those native plants with Neil DeBoe, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. Comes by every so often to talk with us, and it's always great to have him here with us right up until 12:30 today. And, of course, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. You got a kind of a cool event, Prairie Days. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, there's a wonderful group called the Prairie Enthusiasts, which started really here in southwestern Wisconsin and Madison area. And now there are members, chapters in Minnesota, Iowa. And what is happening here is some of the chapters are having an event called Prairie Days on Saturday, September the 7th. And our local Prairie Sands chapter, which is Marquette County, Washera County, Green Lake County, all the way up to Stevens Point, there's seven counties in our chapter. We're having an all-day event in Coloma at the Coloma City Park, and a lot of people probably don't know where Coloma is because it's a little town. It's if you're driving north on I-39 from Westfield, from Madison.
From Madison.
Yeah, in about an hour and 15 minutes from Madison, you'll hit Westfield where Prairie Nursery is, and you go to the next exit, and that's Coloma at Highway 21. And so it starts at 8 o'clock at the Coloma Park Pavilion, mm-hmm. and we're going to have tours of people's prairie gardens and large restorations really big restorations, like, 80 acres, 100 some acres for birds, butterflies, etc.
Wow.
And there's going to be all kinds of other folks there. There's going to be a flint napper, Gary Eldred, who was one of the co-founders of the Prairie Enthusiasts many, many years ago, has very kindly agreed to come up, and he will demonstrate his arrowhead making capacity. This is a funny story. I went to visit Gary many years ago and got to his house a little bit before he got home from work. Sat on his front porch and there were all these little busted up arrowheads. I said, Gary, where'd you find all these busted up arrowheads? And he went in his kitchen and pulled out a gallon Ziploc bag full of perfect arrowheads. Said, I make them. Those are the ones I messed up. So he's going to be there. And there's going to be all kinds of information on how to restore our prairies. And Fish and Wildlife will be there. The Wild Turkey Federation, Ducks Unlimited, Pheasants Forever are co-sponsoring this.
Wow.
And there's going to be poetry, music. So there's all going to be all kinds of wonderful, wonderful things going on all day long.
And that is September 7th.
Saturday, September 7th in Coloma City Park, about an hour and a half north of Madison. So,
and free and open to the public?
Free and open to the public. And, of course, there is the flea market will also be at the city park that Saturday, as always. So you can kill two birds with one stone.
All right. There we go. Well, Kathy in Amherst, I don't know if she's going to make it to Coloma, but she has a question for you nevertheless. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I have some bee balm that grew this year. It's beautiful. It got huge. The flowers were pretty, and now it's covered with, I believe it's powdery mildew. And I guess that doesn't really kill the plant, but how do I treat it?
The Monardas are particularly prone to powdery mildew, and it's turning all white and kind of dusty looking, right, Kathy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. Right.
The best way to treat it is preemptively. At this point, it's really hard to do anything about it. The general procedure, if you have other plants nearby of the same species, or roses are also particularly susceptible to powdery mildew, the first thing you do is to cut back all the bad leaves or the entire plant and just get it out of there.
Okay, really?
To prevent it from infecting other plants. If everything's already infected, then, well, you're kind of stuck. Preemptive treatment involves you can use either a fungicide, which is designed for controlling powdery mildew, and these are commonly available at garden centers. And some people prefer to use an organic method using elemental sulfur. which you can dust or spray onto the plant. It's usually in a spray. You mix it in a spray formulation.
Elemental sulfur.
Yes, it's just straight sulfur, and that helps to control the fungi that cause the powdery mildew. For optimal control, it's generally recommended that you alternate between a powdery mildew fungicide and elemental sulfur. That seems to give you the best control, and you're looking at usually probably treating it once every 7 to 14 days. So
do nothing this year?
Well, if it's all white and you don't have any other, if all your plants are affected?
Yeah, just the bee balm.
But I mean,
okay,
but I mean, you don't have any other bee balm plants that are not affected, correct?
Not in that area.
Yeah.
I have some bee balms on the other side of the house that are not infected.
Yeah. Probably to prevent more, the spores are going to hang around. Probably the best thing is just to cut it down and remove it from your property, and then you'll at least reduce the opportunity for it to spread next year.
So get rid of it.
Yeah, Larry said, don't mess around, get rid of it. So, and, be proactive next year and
okay.
treat the plants before you see signs.
Okay. All right.
And I think that will help you next year. But Monardas are very, very susceptible. There are some varieties that they claim are resistant to powdery mildew. So you might want to look for those for any future plantings.
All right.
Okay?
All right. Thank you.
You bet. Mm-hmm. Good luck.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Lynn in Coloma. Hello.
Hi, I'm actually in Illinois, but we have a place on Pleasant Lake in Coloma.
Cool.
So I was very excited to hear about Saturday. We'll head over to the park.
Yep, Saturday, September 7th. Yep.
Yeah, we will do that.
Wonderful.
My question is, we are way up high on the lake, and so we've got like this big hill that comes down. Of course, we're very, very sandy.
Yep, pure dry sand.
Lovely, lovely sand.
Mm-hmm.
And we have tried some of your black-eyed Susans in the past. And, of course, they're very different from the ones that come from garden centers. And, we've got this big hill, and it's all weeds, and I would really like to incorporate some natural prairie plants in there.
Mm-hmm.
And because it is full sun, it faces west, it does get hot out there.
Mm-hmm.
The phlox seems to do well, the wild phlox.
Mm-hmm.
Kirk's grandmother has planted tiger lilies. They do well.
Uh-huh.
What else would you suggest for this hill?
Oh boy, there's all kinds of great plants for that. You don't have one of our catalogs by chance, do you?
I have had in the past. We'll probably come by and pick one up.
Yeah.
On one of the weekends we're up there coming up this fall.
Okay. In our catalog, it's organized by soil types, and
okay.
Sun and soil, and so there's a lot of great plants listed for sandy, dry soils. And one plant that's really good for your area, our area, is the butterfly weed.
I love that. That's the orange one, right?
That's correct. Yep, it does very well in sand. Prairie smoke is a small little early blooming plant, which is beautiful.
Yeah.
There's a number of asters. There's the heath aster, the sky blue aster. These do extremely well in a dry, sandy soil.
Okay.
The coreopsises do well. We have a couple, stiff coreopsis and also lance leaf coreopsis. And a number of the native sunflowers, like western sunflower, will do great there. And blazing star, rough blazing star, is really amazingly tough plant that grows really almost in sand dunes. And if you're interested in the Karner blue butterfly, the wild lupine loves dry sandy soil. And also one of the best plants for the butterflies themselves for our nectar source is the dotted mint, which also grows in very dry sandy soil.
Okay, now do they attract hummingbirds as well?
There are various plants that will. If you plant a wild petunia, that's a pretty dry plant. If it's really dry sand, I wouldn't put wild petunia in, but that's good for hummingbirds. Sometimes we'll see hummingbirds on the blazing stars. That's not uncommon. And also, another thing you'll see on the blazing stars is the hummingbird moth, which is a very cool insect.
Yeah.
It looks just like a
I just saw a picture the other day online. They're very cool.
They're extremely cool, and they come to a lot of our different prairie plants. And then finally, there's some goldenrods. The showy goldenrod and stiff goldenrod grow on very dry soils, as well as hoary vervain, one of the verbenas. So there's a lot to choose from. I wish I could send you to our website, but until our site's back up, I can't. But again, you can call.
We drive right by you guys all the time, so we'll just have to stop in.
Great.
But What is the best time to plant a lot of these prairie plants, in the fall or wait till spring?
Either time. You can do them in April 15th through people have been planting all summer because it's been a pretty good summer until recently. It hasn't been so hot.
Yeah.
But you can put them in now as long as you can get them nice and watered in. And you can stop by our retail store there northwest of Westfield and pick up plants also.
Very good. Thank you.
Good luck.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And a Facebook question from Ruth. I planted some native, is it penstemons?
Penstemons.
Penstemons. Some pink, some purple. One that should have been purple had white flowers instead. Will the seeds from the white one produce white flowers or revert to purple?
That's a really good question. That depends upon the provenance of that white penstemon. And I don't know which one you've got. I'm not... There are white penstemons. We sell a white penstemon called Penstemon digitalis. If that penstemon is true breeding, meaning of that species, then the seeds from that will indeed be white. If, on the other hand, it was selected as an albino, albinism is in plant flowers is almost always a straight recessive dominant characteristic, and albinism is a homozygous recessive condition, meaning that both of the alleles on the plant are recessive, if that makes any sense for all you geneticists out there. And if it interbreeds with other members that are not white, you will get almost all the original color, unless it's true breeding with itself, and then some of the seeds that it crossed with itself will be white. But usually that's not the case. So when I've dabbled around in this, and I have actually some true breeding lines of albino blazing stars, and I have to keep them completely segregated, and I have them now where they're completely true breeding white. But if they outcross with other ones, then they'll revert to their original color.
Someone was concerned because you mentioned the use of Roundup and similar products, which the person was worried about killing bees and so forth.
As far as I know, Roundup does not affect bees. Now, there's a lot of controversy about any kind of herbicide, pesticide, et cetera. We don't use any pesticides at our nursery because we encourage all of the insects. They're our pollinators, and they make seeds for us, and they're our friends. And so we don't use any insecticides or other insecticide, pesticide, et cetera. We do use glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup. I used to not use any herbicides, but I found that in order to be anything approaching successful, I had to kill the weeds. And you can till the soil repeatedly every 3 weeks for a year or two to kill weeds. You can smother it, but you can't really smother like 20 acres when you're putting in 20-acre planting. That's kind of hard to do, and that's a lot of black plastic, and then you can't recycle it, and it came from oil to start with, so you have an environmental impact statement that may pale in comparison to the use of Roundup. So I guess we view it as a necessary evil to achieve a greater good. But as far as I know, Roundup does not – the actual chemical itself does not affect pollinators, bees, et cetera.
An email from Kristen in River Falls. Could you please discuss neonicotinoid sprays and how they affect plants and pollinators?
I bet Larry knows more about this than I do. It's a huge issue right now, is because these nicotinoids are being applied, and a lot of people are saying this is causing not only the collapse of bee populations, but also monarch butterflies, et cetera. And you have some of these plants that have been bred to also produce these nicotinoids. And, I mean, look at the monarchs this year. I don't have the data. I can't sit here and tell you that I know, but the monarch populations have essentially crashed. And our nursery is usually full of monarchs, and they are only occasional. My yard is usually full of monarchs in my prairie. I'm seeing very few. Mm-hmm. Some people say it's happening in Mexico. Other people saying it's because of our agricultural processes here. I can tell you one thing. We used to have lots and lots of common milkweed in our cornfields because farmers couldn't kill it. But now with Roundup Ready corn and beans, it actually does kill the common milkweed. And you see less and less numbers of this. So the food source that used to be there is diminishing. And the nicotinoids, I'm not an expert at this. I can't speak to this, but there's a lot of concern about this. I believe in Europe, these were outlawed just a few weeks ago.
Ellen in Waupun, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. I have a question that's just a little bit off, but it's this morning, a friend and I were walking a trail, and this was a trail that's in the natural woods near the city, and we noted a scent that seemed powerfully of like maple nut flavoring. And we were wondering what it might have been. Obviously, maybe a maple source, but...
Well, that's a real... Ellen, I love your question. In my time, I've cleaned a lot of seeds. And different seeds and the material around the seed, the husks, have very distinctive smells.
Yeah.
And a few of them, I thought, man, I can make perfume out of this. And the only plant that I know, and you're in the woods, you normally in the plant that I would think of that has this smell grows in more sunny areas, and it's called Sweet Everlasting, Nephalium obtusifolium. And it has a little white flower, it may be 1 foot tall, and if you crush the flower, it smells like maple syrup.
Wow. We were at the edge.
Okay.
Okay. So the sun was, so it's a small, like a foot tall, did you say?
Yeah, it might get 18 inches to 24 inches maximum. And it's very silvery leaves and white flowers. And it's called, not what I just say. Sweet Everlasting. There's Pearly Everlasting, which is Anopheles margaritaceae, which is very similar in appearance. They're very closely related. And then there's Sweet Everlasting, Nephalium, and that starts with a G, G-N-A-P-H-A-L-I-U-M. Learn that Latin. Nephalium obtusifolium. And right now is the time when those seed heads are ripe. You squeeze them in your fingers, and it smells very much like maple syrup. And there's all sorts of plants you can do. I mean, it's just amazing. You know, it's so funny when you read the guides for plants, it's all based upon flower characteristics. It's all very complicated. Why don't you just say, squeeze the flowers and it smells like maple syrup? I mean, come on. It's so obvious. Put that in a guide.
Well, I thank you for the information.
You bet.
Yeah, why wouldn't they put that in there?
Because it's not the appropriate way. You know, different cultures do things different ways, and that's not the scientific method. We ignore some of our senses. And if you notice in botany, remember that Linnaeus, when he developed the binomial nomenclature system, it's all based upon flower characteristics and structure.
Yeah.
So that's what drives the whole system, so that's how you do it. But for the average person who is not a botanist and who is not going to memorize all these Latin names that those guys are going to change every other week anyway.
Yeah.
Who cares? Okay, I need a method that's going to tell me what the heck is that plant. I think, you know, you look at Native Americans, they use different methodologies for identifying plants that we just completely and utterly ignore. Apparently, the Egyptians were very, very scent-oriented.
Ah.
And the ancient Egyptians, okay? And apparently, and I'm not an expert on this, you know, I don't sit there and read the hieroglyphs, believe me, but apparently they used scent very, very much in their descriptions as well. So I think it depends upon your culture's prejudices or orientations as far as which senses you use preferentially, and I think we tend to ignore our senses of smell.
Yeah, we talked about this on the show, on the Garden Talk show not long ago, about planning your garden based on scent.
Oh, I think it's a great idea. Yeah.
And it was a good show. It was a lot of fun.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yep. To talk about it.
Yeah, and it adds a whole new element to your garden.
Mark Dwyer was our guest day.
Yeah.
So from the talk about that Rotary Gardens and so forth in Janesville. Bill in West Salem, we'll get to you in just a second. Just a reminder that we're visiting today with Neil DeBoll, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller. Here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at prairie plants today and late summer care for our native plants with our guest, Neil DeBoll, president of Prairie Nursery. Thank you for listening in, by the way. Join in at 800-642-1234. Give a call. Let's turn to Bill in West Salem next. Bill, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hello, guys. Larry, Neil. A question on bergamot. I believe it's native. Square stemmed.
Yep.
Only reason I know that is because my dad taught me that years ago.
Yep.
And I want to know how to save the seeds or whatever so I can transplant.
Okay, really simple. When those flower heads turn into seed heads, they'll turn brown.
Yep.
And to tell when the seed is ripe, you can just tip the plant or just, you know, break the top one and just take one. And if the seeds just fall right out,
yep.
That seed head, they're ready to go. Just go and clip them off. I just yank them off by hand. They come right off. And then I grind them up. You can just rub them across a screen if you don't have a lot of them. And have to make sure the screen is the right size. You know, a window screen is a little bit too small. You need the next size up. The seeds will fall right through that screen. And you have got a seed and kind of a dusty seed head mix. It depends if then we put it through a fanning mill to clean it up so it's 100% 99.99% pure. You don't necessarily have to do that to plant it. So it's a really simple process. And as the previous caller was talking about plants with smells and scents, the bergamot has a very strong scent, being in the mint family. That's why it has a square stem, because members of the mint family also have square stems. When I clean that seed, man, you got to wear a mask. And if when you and you really clean it down, there's this fine red dust. I don't know what part of that seed head it is, but I'm telling you what, you inhale that stuff and you're going to go on a sneezing tear. So when you're working with
what's that? I don't need that. I already I got enough of ragweed as it is. Hey, all right. So the seeds, then, what do I do? Do I plant them this fall, or just sow them in the ground, or what's
How are you gonna? Do you want to just put them in a place where you want them to come up, or you're gonna put them in a nursery?
I've got a natural select area there.
Okay. Is there open ground in there for them?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Just go out there and scatter that seed on the open ground. It's a small seed. It'll work its way into the ground over the winter, and they should come up next spring.
There you go.
I can do it.
Pretty
Thank
simple.
You
bet.
Yeah, thanks, Bill.
Good luck. Be careful with that stuff.
Dave in Cobb, Wisconsin. Thank you for waiting. Hi.
Good morning. I've got a barn here with a slope bank to it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Okay. You know what I mean, don't you?
Yeah, bank where was it? The bank where you used to drive up to it to put the hay in the barn?
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure.
Thinking, I don't want to be mowing that all the time. What would you recommend to put in, on that bank?
Okay. First of all, whatever you put on that bank, you want to make sure that it is not flammable. And don't do what a buddy of mine's grandma did. She went out and burned off the field, and it went up next to her barn where she hadn't mowed and burned the whole dang barn down, which had these huge black walnut timbers from 1800s, and she lost the whole barn. So whatever you decide to put there, make sure that it is not going to be flammable. If it is something that will be flammable, you want to make sure and keep it mowed so there's no way that fire can get up to your... I assume it's a wooden barn, a stone barn with wood on top, above it, right? Or something
It's a cement wall with a curved arch to it, you know what I mean?
Okay, but it could catch on fire above, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so whatever you put in there, make sure you don't want a bunch of old dead grass sitting there. One mistake, and there it goes. Okay, so it depends upon your soil. It depends upon the sun as far as what you would select to go there. What a lot of people do is they plant our no-mow lawn grass. If you have a sandy soil, a sandy loam, or a loamy soil, it doesn't work real well on heavy clay unless you got about 4 inches of good loose topsoil. But the nice thing about our no-mow lawn mix is that you can only mow it a couple times a year, and it stays green all year.
All year.
And it's not completely fireproof because fire will move through the thatch, but it goes really slowly. Because it stays green all year, you don't get this buildup of dead brown material that can catch on fire and burn really fast. So it's not fireproof, but it's low flammability. So, and it's very low maintenance, and you don't have to fertilize it. It's very drought tolerant. So you may want to investigate that as an option if you just want a low cover that you only have to mow a couple times a year.
Makes good sense. Thanks, Dave, for calling. Appreciate it. So no low mow or no mow?
No mow. Well,
no mow.
Yeah, it's kind of a misnomer because normally you mow it once or twice a year, but it's pretty low maintenance.
We have a Facebook note from Luann, who saw this plant. We had a cool picture of a plant here. Saw this plant along a gravel road up near Springstead in northeast Price County. I know right where Springstead is. It's in an area she walks frequently. No one seems to know what it might be, and wonder if you have a guess. The shot was taken about 3 weeks ago.
I can give you better than a guess. That's Rattlesnake Master. Also known as Eryngium yuccafolium, so named because the leaves look like yucca leaves. This is a really, really cool plant.
It really is.
And it looks like, a lot of people think it's in the thistle family or the yucca family, but believe it or not, it's actually in the carrot family. And as we talked about earlier, plants are classified by their botanical flower characteristics. And this one is closer to your garden carrot than anything else out there. What's very interesting about the Rattlesnake Master, first of all, this, as one customer once said, if I plant this, will I get rattlesnakes in my garden? And I assured her that would not be the case. It is so named because Native Americans brewed a antidote from the root, which they believe was an antidote for rattlesnake bite. Fortunately, I have never had to test this, but that is how it got its name. But it's particularly interesting. It has white flowers. They look almost like golf balls.
Yeah.
And this plant, you'll rarely see a butterfly on it. It is primarily pollinated by wasps. Now, you would say, why in the world, would I ever plant a plant that's pollinated by wasps? But remember that in nature, there are predaceous wasps and there are parasitic wasps. And the wasps that bedevil us are the predaceous wasps, things like yellow jackets, hornets, etc. But they are very, very much in the minority. The reason we don't know about parasitic wasps is because most of them are very small, or we just don't pay attention to them. And the parasitic wasps attack all kinds of other creatures, everything from tomato hornworms to other garden pests to spiders. I mean, there is a just about a parasitic wasp for every invertebrate out there. And as E.O. Wilson famously said, the entomologist at Harvard University said that the hymenoptera, which include bees, wasps, and ants, he said the hymenoptera are the little things that make the world run right. And mostly it's because of those parasitic wasps that just, they're always taking out somebody. So they keep everything in control so nobody gets out of control. And I had a customer who had terrible problems with tomato hornworms in his food garden, and he planted one of our prairie mixes, just a 1,000 square feet, and once the plants started blooming, including the rattlesnake master, his tomato hornworm problems disappeared.
Went away.
And he said, the prairie is my pesticide. I don't have to spray any pesticides. The prairie, all the insects that come to the prairie go in and keep all the bad guys in control in my garden.
Wonderful. Well, that's a great photo. Go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show if you want to take a look at it. It's really pretty cool. Sharon in Berlin has a comment. Hi, Sharon.
Good morning. I have a pest. It's a vine and climbs and goes all over the trees and the bushes. It doesn't go in the cornfields, I noticed. Maybe that's because of what the farmers use. But looked it up finally in Minnesota Extension and found that it's wild cucumber.
Yep.
And I pulled it off of the trees that are, you know, in my yard. But does it do harm? And can we expect it back next year? It didn't come last year, but I suppose because it was too dry. I've seen it up north in Barron and Dunn County.
It's everywhere. It's very interesting.
Yes, it is everywhere.
Yes. This is wild cucumber, Echinocystis lobata, and it is a native annual. And it's in the same family as cucumbers and squashes. And there was almost none of it last year, I'm sure, because it was very dry. And so the question is, why do we have this wild cucumber just taking over along the roadsides everywhere this year? I've been thinking about this a lot, and I don't know that I have the answer. But because of the drought last year, there were perennial plants, grasses, and other plants that experienced damage. And therefore, their roots were weakened, thus opening up habitat in the soil. Well, the wild cucumber is an annual. And annuals generally rely upon open soil to germinate and grow. So if there was a reduction in the sod of the grasses along our roadsides last year, that theoretically opened up opportunities for dormant seeds of the wild cucumber to germinate. And then we had all that rain in the spring, and it just went gazonkers. It was a perfect growing conditions for it, and it goes crazy. And now that it's drier, most of the members of the Cucurbitaceae, the cucumber family, are drought tolerant. So it doesn't seem to be really suffering or feeling any pain as we go into this drier. So, and you know what's really cool? I drive around with my windows down, and it has a really nice fragrance to it when you drive by it.
So, yes, it does.
So will it be back next year? I would be surprised. I'm almost positive it will not be back at the same levels as it was this year. But it's going to make a lot of seeds this year, and it's going to be just poised for the next opportunity. And it has very large seeds, which means it probably has a fairly long lifespan in the soil. And a lot of your annuals are opportunistic, and they have to stay dormant in the soil for a long time. And when you get another right set of conditions, it's going to come back, and you'll get another display like this year. But I have never seen anything like this in my life.
So we have to live with it.
Well, you can go and rip it down. You know, you're probably not going to see it come back with the vengeance that you saw this year, but I can't predict that. But I'd be very surprised if it did. But if it's
not harmful other than it covers everything.
Yeah, I mean, I've always let it grow up my trees because I think it looks cool. So for me, it's an ornamental, but I don't have it, you know, taking over the whole woods. It's just here and there normally. I don't have any at my property this year for some reason, but along the roadside, just going crazy. So it shouldn't do any long-term damage. You may see.
Is it poisonous at all?
Not that I'm aware of, but I'm the wrong person to ask about that, Larry. I don't know. I don't eat it, but it's a fascinating little plant, and it's going to town this year.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Mike and Dousman. Hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've got a question on the Lomo grass.
Yeah.
I've actually bought some from you and have it two different areas, but it's shady and filtered sun, and it's doing wonderful. But I've got another area that's a hillside, full sun, and it's angled, so that angle is straight south hitting the sun, so it's a much hotter than normal spot.
Mm-hmm. Well, is that going to work?
Yeah. Have you planted it there, or are you thinking about planting it there?
Well, here's what I did. It also goes down to the highway, so I think it's going to get a little salt from the highway, this hill. And what I did is last fall, I used glyphosate and sprayed it because it was full of quackgrass. And then I sprayed it this spring again, and then I sprayed it this summer because that quackgrass comes up a few times. And it's completely dead. So
it's completely dead.
Yeah, you can go ahead and plant that in September. Perfect planting. You may have to water that from time to time because that south-facing slope is going to be pretty tough on it. It has deep roots once it's established, but for the first 2 years, you're going to have to help it to get established. And if you get a hot, dry year like last year, you're going to want to water it every 3 weeks or so with a good deep watering. Then you should be fine. But if you can't water it and you get a really dry weather, you might be in trouble.
So get the hose out.
Get the hose out for the first couple of years. But it's tough stuff. It's really tough stuff. But if you get a weather like last year, then you're going to have to water it occasionally.
And thanks a lot for calling, Mike. Appreciate it. Neil DeBull, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. It's always a pleasure to have Neil with us. He talks a lot about prairies and does a wonderful job of it as well. So great to have him with us for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Native plants add a lot of beauty and interest to a landscape, and besides that, they also create a very healthy habitat for all kinds of wildlife as well, insects and animals. Larry Mueller here. Glad you could join us today on the Ideas Network for this edition of Garden Talk, visiting with Neil DeBull. Neil is president of Prairie Nursery, knows obviously a lot about native and woodland plants and grasses, has great advice to share. I hope you'll join in with questions for him at 1-800-642-1234. And if you call right now, we'll get you on pretty much right away. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. Neil, thanks again for spending time with us.
Thank you, Larry.
We have a pretty cool photo on my Facebook page that Bridget sent us. I got this annula a few years ago. It looks very, very pretty. The bees and the butterflies love it. Grows to about 6 feet. Very long spear-shaped leaves that can be used for leaf casting. I love it.
Yeah, it's a nice plant. Inula helenium. And it's actually not a native plant. It's been brought here as a garden plant. It generally seems to behave itself well. It doesn't seem to escape. At least I haven't seen it escaping. It looks kind of like our silphiums, especially the cup plant, Silphium perfoliatum. So sometimes people confuse it with the cup plant or the rosinweed, which have similar leaves and similar flowers. But it seems to perform similarly. It likes a richer soil. It doesn't grow well in sand. It likes kind of a heavier soil. Clay soils, it does very, very well. So
there we go. Richard in Huntley, Illinois, has a question. Hi, Richard.
Hi. Hey, it's a great show. I've got my prairie's about 25 years old now. It's about 2-3 acres. And bad advice many years ago is I put in sumac.
Yes.
I cut them down. Now I'm getting, and I burned this area, but they love the fire. And I want to get rid of it before it invades my major prairie areas, and I'm not sure what to do now.
Well, you got three options. You can do what I did years ago, back when I was a boy. And I had this area. It was a big, giant sumac stand, and I wanted a food garden. And I went and cut them all down, and I dug each and every one of them out. And it was an area about 40 by 20, and let me tell you, that was a job. I got a real nice food garden, But you have to, because the sumac, as you know, it creeps by underground woody rhizomes, and it can creep like 3 to 5 feet a year. It is a, sometimes referred to as the shock troops of the forest, because at the prairie forest ecotone, the edge between the prairie and the forest, you usually will see plants like sumac and others, but the sumac will expand the forest by invading into the prairie. So you can go in there and dig them out if you want to do it organically, which is what I did because I was putting in a food garden. The other choice is you can go in there and you can, if you just have grasses, you can use a broadleaf herbicide and spray the leaves like right now. And that will translocate down in the roots and kill it. I don't like to use broadleaf herbicides. The only one that I use is called Milestone, which is the only broadleaf that has received the EPA's reduced risk designation. And it does have a long-term residence time in the soil, but it has very low toxicity to mammals, pets, birds, all the, you know, all kinds of wildlife, etc. The third choice is to simply cut them down, cut the stalks down to the ground in the fall, and then apply concentrated 40% glyphosate herbicide, also known as Roundup, right to that cut stump at the ground level. That will go down in the root and kill the majority of it. Usually, this first treatment doesn't kill it all because those are extensive rhizomes, and you will probably see resprouts come up the next year, and then you will have to either dig those out or retreat them in the fall of the next year. Fall is the time to do this. Spring does not work. Fall and winter is the time to use the cut stump method because that is the time at which the herbicide will translocate down into the roots. Spring, early summer, even midsummer is not nearly as effective as late summer, fall, and winter. And that will take out most of your sumac. So it depends on how you want to do it.
You can do it right in the cold of the winter, eh?
Yes, you can. I kill buckthorn, honeysuckle, box elder, sumac. I go in until the sap starts to move in spring. This year, I was able to stay out there till almost mid-April because it was such a cold spring.
Yeah.
And the way you tell this is you cut the target species and just let it sit for a minute or two, and you'll see if there's moisture beating up on the surface of the cut stump, then you know the sap is coming up, and it's too late. Once the upward movement of the sap is coming, the herbicide will not be translocated down into the roots. But I've cut all the way into early April. As long as that stump is dry 2 minutes after you cut it, that herbicide will go down in the root, and I'll tell you what, you'll kill your buckthorn, you'll kill your honeysuckle, you'll kill your sumac, fall and winter. And I like to do it also in the fall because the leaves are off, and the plant has taken a lot of its moisture out of the stem, so they're lighter, easier to work with, and it's not so doggone hot.
That's good because the one thing is I don't like spraying either, especially when I've got a pretty established prairie, and I just don't want drift and stuff. So
you definitely don't want to do that.
Yep. I'm going to do the cutting, but there's a lot of little ones. I'm going to be on my hands and knees for a long winter.
It's a lot of hands and knees. Buy yourself a pair of those rubber knee pads, because especially in the snow, because I did that once without it, and I'll tell you what, I wrecked my knees on that cold ground. So put those knee pads on if you're out there.
Good luck, Richard. Thank you for calling. John in Dubuque, Iowa. Hi.
Hello. My question is about the growth habit of the warm season grasses. At what point do they have a taproot?
Actually,
how long after they germinate?
Actually, they don't actually have taproots per se. They are fibrous rooted. In fact, almost all of your grasses are fibrous rooted. There are some that are rhizomatous, meaning that they have roots more towards the surface. But as opposed to some of our flowers that do have true deep taproots. But as far as the depth of rooting, the prairie grasses and prairie flowers in general, with some notable exceptions, but for the most part, they extend their roots down into the lower soil as soon as possible because they want to get down where there's moisture in anticipation of summer drought. And that's kind of I'm anthropomorphizing here. They don't want to, but that's their adaptation, is they need to get those roots down as soon as they can. So typically, the roots will grow quite rapidly down into the lower soil. The exceptions to this are on heavy clay soils that may dry out in the summer, and the roots can no longer penetrate down into that lower soil. But in sandy soils and sandy loams, they will continue to go down as pretty far. And as far as the depth of rooting, the depth of the roots will depend upon the species. Some of the shallower rooted grasses, like June grass, may only go a foot and a half. Little bluestem will go 3 to 4 feet. Side oats grama, usually 2 feet. Indian grass, 5 feet. Big bluestem, 6 feet. Switchgrass, 7 feet, depending on the soil type. So some of these grasses do go down almost 8 feet deep.
There you go.
So you can't start them. You can't start them and then transplant them.
Oh, absolutely you can. Grasses are easy. Yeah, as long as you don't. And, in fact, you can dig up a mature clump of any of the prairie grasses You just get a really sharp spade, and you have to go down 12 to 18 inches, and it's really, 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 really a lot of work, but it can be done. I've transplanted and divided all of them, but be ready for a lot of work. It's easier just to start the plants or buy the plants as pots and put them in the ground.
John, thanks a lot for calling. Speaking of transplanting, we had a Facebook question from Ned, who said, I've transplanted a lot of my native flowers this July and August in Green Bay. Not sure that was a great idea. Very slow in coming back.
Ned, that was not a great idea, depending on the species. Unless they were dormant, like spring ephemerals, then that would be fine. No, that's probably the worst time to transplant them because, especially prairie plants, most of them are reaching their peak activity in midsummer at that time. And so when you disturb the roots during that time of activity, that can really, really set the plant back. And there's always root damage, almost always root damage, depending on the species and the rooting habit. And normally, if you do transplant during the growing season, you need to cut the plants back so that there is a more equal relationship between the root and the stems, because when the root is damaged during transplanting, you have to cut back the leaves because the leaves still say, I need water, I need water. And the roots say, I'm sorry, I only got two-thirds of my roots, can't help you guys. And that's where you're going to run into problems. Best thing to do, wait until the plants go dormant in October or do them early in spring, March or April. Then you will not have any transplant shock.
Lori in Crivets. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hello. I tried planting some seeds for my purple coneflower. I also had some of the little blue-eyed grass and a wild petunia, and nothing has come up. Now, I've been gone for a week, and I just wanted to see what I would get out of these plants, and nothing's come. How hard are those to grow? And you had mentioned earlier the everlasting plant. I was told that a plant that I had on my property was Pearly Everlasting, which I always thought smelled like brown sugar. I used to have it in the country when I grew up, but I haven't seen it since, and unfortunately has not come back since summer before last. And is that native, and is there any way to find those anywhere or encourage that?
Well, both the Pearly Everlasting, which doesn't have the brown sugar smell, and the Sweet Everlasting, which does have the brown sugar smell, are very similar, very closely related. They are native, and they're short-lived. In fact, I think Anopheles is an annual. I'm not sure. I have to check that out. Or if they're not annuals, they're very short-lived. So they will show up in areas and then disappear on a whim, because it just kind of depends on the growing conditions that encourage them. They're usually on drier soils, up like you would have up in Crivets, so that's where you normally will see them, not exclusively, but often. But as far as your seeds, when did you plant these seeds, Larry?
Just a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, there's your problem. Okay. Yeah. Seeds are smart. Seeds say, okay, I got planted the first week in August. Guess what? Terrible time to germinate. I'll just wait till next year. Thank you very much. Because they don't have sufficient time of season left in order to develop a good root system. Had you planted them in May or June, even early July, you probably would have seed germination. However, the blue-eyed grass is one of these plants that is an obligate moist stratification plant. So it has to go through the winter in the ground in order to break dormancy. You get very, very low germination if you don't do that. It's also a cool season plant, and its window of opportunity for germination is usually April into early May. So keep an eye on these. I bet you that these seeds will come up next spring, April, and May.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
You bet. Good luck.
And Jim in Fontana, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. We're doing some prairie. We actually got a couple different systems on about 25 acres. We got some prairie, some hickory woods, and a stream bank, and a wetland. But our main idea with a neighbor is to put goats into the prairie that's right now very diminished with honeysuckle and buckthorn and box elder, and it's pretty much almost 100% of that. The other area is a very fine hickory woods that has hickories of all sizes, hundreds of them, about 8 acres, a few mature old hickories, and then sizes from a foot off the ground to 6 inches in diameter. My question is, it makes sense to cut that buckthorn honeysuckle area and just let the goats out there to resprout next spring. That seems pretty easy. But my neighbor wants to put them in the hickory grove. I'm afraid they'll eat up too many of the small hickories along with the buckthorn and the honeysuckle and other junk that's in there. Any experience with that?
Absolutely. I've used goats on a couple of projects to clean out poison ivy. and all kinds of vines, grapevines, and Solastris orbiculatus. This was in a project out east in the Philadelphia area, and they will eat everything. And if you want to keep those trees, you better put big, heavy-duty fences around them and make sure they're fenced outside of the tree, because they'll stick their heads through it. It'll strip the bark right off those trees
They'll take the bark right off those young hickories.
They'll take the bark off of everything. They'll take the bark off a mature tree. Goats are indefatigable.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. That would be a lot of work to protect all those trees. I think we should put them over on the prairie, the solid buckthorn area.
Yeah, put them in the prairie after the prairie goes dormant. Put them in there in the winter, and they'll eat up all that woody vegetation. They'll eat it right to the ground.
Yeah. My neighbor says, Jim, it's a good deal. You can get neutered goats for male goats for about $10, and they'll eat anything.
They'll eat anything.
I'm thinking, but what kind of a job interview is that for the goats? You say, here's the deal. You come to our place, and we neuter you and feed you thistles. Where do I sign up?
They're amazing. They really are. But remember, they're going to eat everything. They will strip the bark off your mature trees. So I would not put them in the woods whatsoever. They're wonderful. I love goats. They're affectionate and wonderful and fun, but they will eat everything.
Thanks very much for calling. We had a photo here from Leslie in Ashford who wonders what this plant is. And I'm having a little trouble seeing. Oh, there's a flower of it, I think.
Okay. It's hard to tell exactly, but it looks like a selection of Rudbeckia laciniata, which is one of our native green-headed coneflower is the common name. Latin name is Rudbeckia laciniata. That's what the leaves look like and the height. It's a big, tall plant. Yeah, there's the leaves. It's almost certainly Rudbeckia laciniata, and it's some selection where you have these big, furry flowers that are like double flowers or something. So I think that's probably what you've got there.
All right. And let's go back to the phones. Mona in Appleton. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I bought some bulbs online and for trilliums. I think they're like the burgundy ones and some white ones, and I planted them, I'd say 3 years ago. They come up every year, no flowers.
How big
were they? They have some Jack in the Pulpit. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, they were kind of small, like dime-sized bulbs. They were pretty tiny.
Okay.
But the plant comes up, and the Jack in the Pulpit are doing great in that area, and some ferns and stuff that, that is like same condition type. Plants.
Yeah, I think they're just a little bit young. Trilliums take a really long time to grow. I grow them from seed. Oh. It takes like 6 to 8 years to get a white flower, large flower trillium to go from seed to flower, 5 to 7, depending on your soil. So these are probably just still young, and probably another year or two, normally you would expect them to bloom. Now, it depends on
what. Yeah, I was hoping that it maybe, when you just said that, I was hoping maybe since they were bulbs, it would be a little quicker, but. Yeah, I'd say it's been at least 3 years. I don't really remember when I bought them and planted them, but they did come up every single year.
Yeah. All bulbs are not created equal, and we sell trillium.
Sorry.
We sell the large flower trillium, and the plants that we sell usually will bloom the year they're planted. But that's because they're like 7 years old.
So you sell the bigger bulbs?
The white flower trillium.
I got on the show late. Where can I get those?
Oh, you can call us for a catalog. Our number is 1-800-476-9453, and there are people there to help you out and get your catalog.
And is that going to be on the Larry Mueller page? The number?
I think we already have. We may already have it up there, but Judith will have it up in a minute. Otherwise,
all right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks.
Good luck.
And let's turn to Jim in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Hey, cup plants. I got just an amazing crop this year. They're 9-10 feet tall. I'm wondering, is there any practical use for a cup plant?
That's a really good question. First of all, it's a very practical plant for birds because it's one of the best wildlife plants you can plant.
And
it's called cup plant because the cups clasp the leaves. The stems. Uh-huh. The leaves clasp the stems. And then rainfall collects there, and you get all kinds of birds coming for a drink, and other insects and pollinators will utilize that water. And, of course, the flowers bring in the bugs, and then the birds eat the bugs, and then the flowers make seeds, and they're very sunflower-like seeds, and the birds go crazy on them.
How about limiting their propagation?
Yeah, that is a problem. Cup plant is a very successful plant, and it loves to spread by seed. A practical use for them, actually, there was a lot of research done in the old Soviet Union, back in the old days when communists still were on the Soviet Union. They did some very interesting research on using cup plant for forage because it produces such a volume of material, and it grows on heavy soils, soils that may be problematic for other crops. Cup plant does well, and it's a perennial crop. It comes back year after year after year, so you only have to plant it once or very, you know, cyclically. Yeah. And so they did a lot of research, and they blended the cup plant with forage grasses to get the right balance of protein, moisture, et cetera. And I don't know, since Soviet Union break up, I don't know what happened to the research. But they did this very interesting research, and I haven't followed up on it. But that was the only thing that I know beyond wildlife that people were actually using this for forage. So,
okay. Can I ask one other thing? You were talking about sumacs earlier.
Yeah.
There's this plant that's just become very, very popular in boulevards and various plantings. It tends to stay small. It has a leaf structure and a trunk structure. It looks a lot like a sumac, except the leaf is not smooth on the edge. It's frilly. And I'm convinced that it's a form of sumac because this year I saw one bloom with the same kind of pod that a sumac has.
Okay, how tall was it?
Do you know anything about that?
How tall was it?
They seem to stay so far about 3 feet, 4 feet, and get more bush-like than tall.
Well, there's a Grolo sumac. There's also a cutleaf sumac, which stays a little bit shorter, but yeah, it gets 6-8 feet. And just the leaves alone are not necessarily indicative of paternity or maternity, because leaf form can be similar between species that are not related. So very hard to say without knowing a little bit more about the actual.
Well, they get that seed pod like a sumac does.
So those red red seed pods?
Yeah. Same color and everything. I tell you what, I'll take some photographs and I'll put them on the Facebook page and send them to you.
There you go.
All right.
Excellent.
That sounds great. Thank
okay,
you.
Super.
Thanks, Jim. Bill and Wapan, you have a quick question?
Good afternoon. I have a planting of wildflowers. It's about 6 foot wide by 20 feet long, and it just grows. I mean, I've got wildflowers all summer long, year after year, but it seems to be getting so thick that they no longer want to stand up. They fall over, and someone told me that's because it's too thick in there. And my question is how do I thin that out?
Boy, that's an interesting situation, Bill. Normally when plants get thicker, they tend to support one another, and they don't fall over. Bill, do you fertilize this at all?
No.
Okay, and you're in Waupun. You have that beautiful black Waupun soil, right?
Yes, we do.
Yeah. Normally, when we see plants falling over, it's because they're getting tall and leggy, which is usually a function of excess nitrogen, encouraging stem growth and leaf growth. Or if you have tons and tons of flower heads, they get so heavy that they flop over. Is that possibly what's going on?
I don't know. It just seems like here and there, there's a group of them that just kind of just start to collapse. And I know a lady that knows a lot about flowers, and I asked her about it, and she said, oh, that's because they're too thick. But I'm not sure she was correct on that.
I've never actually seen that myself. Bill, what are the flowers? Do you know what species they are?
I don't know what species they are. And that's one of the things I have to do next spring is I have no reds in there. I have all kinds of shades of purples and blues and yellows. I have all kinds of yellows.
Yeah. Boy, that's a mystery. I honestly, it's running counterintuitively to what you would expect.
You could take a picture of it and post it, put it up on our Facebook page, and Neil can take a look at it from there and maybe have a good answer for you, Bill. Thanks very much for calling. And Neil, thank you.
My pleasure.
It's always a pleasure.
It's always great to be on Garden Talk and to get all the great calls from your listeners, Larry. Thank you so much.
And Neil is, of course, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin, and we're all hoping that his website eventually comes back.
It'll be back.
And in the meantime, what's the 800 number again? 800?
1-800-476-9453. That's 1-800-GROW-WILD.
Neil DeBoll. We'll have him back again. Thank you all for listening. Weather Guy's coming up Monday on the Ideas Network, and we'll also talk about getting the kids ready for kindergarten. Stay with us.